Montgomery, Alabama.
My name is Russ Kelly, and I'm very grateful recovering alcoholic.
Hi, Russ.
Hi, everybody. God, it's great to be here. I look back over the years and think what I was at one time and where I've come, and I know where all that power came from. It came from my higher power and from people that he sent into my life like you. So for that, I'm really grateful. I always say, you know, that heaven is my first home and AA is my second, and that's important to me because when you get there, in my recovery program, I have never experienced such love, such joy, such peace, such fellowship, such honesty, and such laughter. And I like all of those things combined. I learned something when I became an alcoholic, that alcohol will take away from you everything that you love, everything that's important to you, unless it stops. And then, if it's arrested, you can start getting all of that stuff back. And that's part of my story that's going to unfold a little bit for you tonight. What I'd like to say, first of all, is that I want to thank all of you for being part of my life. Because a number of years ago, I was a very sad excuse for a human being. And today, I stand tall, even though I'm short, as a child of God. And I stand tall as a product of the greatest recovery program in all the world, and that is Alcoholics Anonymous. You all are part of that, and I thank you again. It's important to me. I don't know if you ever heard that story about that family that was pretty sick and tired of this drunk that came home every night, and they decided one night they were going to fix him, but good. And when he came home and had his customary drinking bouts, you know, and passed out, they just grabbed him bodily, took him out to the cemetery, dug a hole, stuck him in there, and the only thing left out was his head. And they left him there. And the next morning, you know, the sun came up, and the birds were chirping, and all that kind of good stuff. And he woke up and looked around, and he said, "My God, it's Resurrection Day, and I'm the first one up." And, you know, that's really the story of my life, that, you know, things can be, your life can fall apart and everything else, and you're still standing up there and say, "Oh, this is the greatest life I've ever had." And we're not doing much about anything. Denial was a part of my life for a long time. I can be honest with you and tell you that the greatest problem I had in working through my alcoholism, my doggone ego, people adored their pastor. I was a good one. I was a good one to them. And they liked me, and they put me up on the little pedestal. And they did just about everything that I expected them to do. And I was able to handle the lies of all of these people, at least on the surface. And all the time, things about my own life were beginning to fall apart. And I didn't really notice, you know, exactly what was going on. I always said I can handle it. My life wasn't doing too well there for a while. My family was getting quite unhappy with me. And if any of you ever run into my wife, Barbara, she is something else, let me tell you, that she is the best Al-Anon that I have ever met in my life. And she's a big part of my life today. Because if I have any problems, she knows how to handle me. If I get up in the morning and things aren't right, she'll say, "Well, Russell, it looks like things aren't too well for you today. I certainly hope they get better." And off she goes to live her life and leaves me to live mine. And I'm grateful for that. My spirituality went down the tube as the first thing. And when spirituality goes down the tube, everything else follows it. Pretty soon, you know, the moral values go down, and then the mental abilities, and then the emotional, all that kind of stuff. And I became a wreck. I wanted my life to be a good life. And yet I look back and find out that I just did about everything that wasn't exactly right. Somebody showed me that little book here before tonight, and, you know, I got that written down here. Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. This little Humpty Dumpty fell off the wall, and everybody tried to put him back together again. But only God succeeded. And he did that through people like you. And for that, I'm grateful. I wasn't always as jolly as I am today, and I always wasn't as satisfied as I am with life. And my drinking had progressed to the point that all I wanted to do was drink. And people would try to help me, and I would sort of tell them, well, there's not really anything wrong. Sure, I heard that story about those three clergymen that got picked up for gambling in a small town in the back room in the dark of the night. They were arrested, and the next day they had appeared before the magistrate. And the magistrate looked at the first minister, who was a Roman Catholic priest, and he said to him, now, Father, I want you to tell me the truth. Were you gambling last night? And he got his little rosary out, and he felt the beads, and he said under himself, you know, Holy Mary, Mother of God, bless us sinners now and the day of our death. And he looked the magistrate right in the eye, and he said, I was not gambling. And he asked the Lutheran preacher, were you gambling, Reverend? And he said under his breath, I know that Jesus died on the cross for all my sins, and I know that this little thing I'm about to say will get by him too. So he looked him right in the eye, and he said, I was not gambling. And he turned to that Jewish rabbi, and he said, now, Rabbi, tell me the truth. Were you gambling last night? He said, with whom? Nobody. I had gotten to the point in my life that I became expert at drinking. I drank to everything. You know, the neighbor's cat died. That was an important event we had to celebrate. The lightning was beautiful, and we needed to drink to that. God was wonderful, and I think I probably toasted him more than anything else. I did all the things that that alcoholic people do. You know, I marked the bottles, and I hid the booze, and I had my office full of communion wine right behind all the Bibles because nobody would bother looking there in order to find those things. I had the blackouts. I went through the bit, you know, about the slurred speech, and I was not able to write my name on a check. If I sent the kids to the store, they'd send it back and say, get somebody to sign it that we can read the name. And I felt terrible, and I looked terrible, and I acted terrible, and I hated Russell. And I can remember the night that I was able to get upstairs, you know, stand in front of the mirror and look at that person there, and I would say, you're a hypocrite, and you're a betrayer of Christ, and you're a blasphemer, and you're everything that God doesn't want you to be. And then I would start crying. And I would tell God right there, I will never take another drink as long as I live. Then I'd get up the next morning, and I'd read my Bible. And it says in there that God loves us no matter what we do. To the glory of God, and thank Him for all of His kindness. There were a lot of strange things that began to happen in my life. I'm not going to tell you about all the drinking, because I had gotten to the point, the last 2 years before I quit drinking, I was drunk all the time. And believe it or not, I was able to handle it. And if people did know in that church, they would not do anything about it. Because if they did, they were going to have to deal with themselves. They'd have to admit they had a drunken preacher. And that I don't think they wanted to do. But I started giving money to the kids, which was terrible. I have 8 children, incidentally. You know, so this hour a day bit is not actually true. I always say that I did 10 things right in my life. 8 of them I did because I was told to, and that resulted in the 8 children. And the 9th thing I did was that I quit drinking because I had to, and then the 10th thing that I did right is I joined AA because I wanted to, and that's the best thing that happened in my life for a long time now. And I'm proud of that. But I used to give the kids money, and that was unheard of in those days, because anything that I got, and it was typical at those days, you know, at first, the poor preacher was a true story. That we didn't have that much. I had a lot of grandiosity in my behavior because I felt that I was the greatest thing that happened next to God. Now, I was willing to give Him His place, but I felt that I was the next thing. I don't know if you know, but in the Lutheran Church, of which I'm a clergyman, that we use wine in our communion services. So I started scheduling more communion services at the church. And I always went first to be the good shepherd. You know, the sheep are supposed to follow the shepherd, so that's what I would do. But listen, I needed that at that point in my life. When you walk over there, you know, to do your first service in the morning and you're kind of like this, boy, you better get something going for you. And that helped me to get through a lot of those. Another strange thing that happened in my life, that my drinking got to the point that I had struck a bargain with my family, and especially Barbara, at 4:30. On Saturday afternoon, She locked me in my room so that I couldn't get out and drink because I had to be in good shape. She was the most wonderful enabler. She'd lock me in every Saturday so that I would be sober the next morning. I really believed that there was nothing in this world that I could not do. I had a pattern for buying my booze, you know, up in the area where I was. I picked out five little towns. Every fifth week I'd stop in there. I'd always go to the Catholic stores. Because those Catholics, I love them. They're wonderful people. I'd walk in with my collar on and they'd say, "Hello, Father." And I'd tell them, I said, "The bishop is coming over. We got to have something on hand for him." And when I told them that, I always got a 25% discount on top of that. So I thought that worked out pretty good. I used to drive around drunk. I carried booze with me to the pastor's conferences. You know, I didn't think anything about that. And I'd ask these guys when it got boring, because there's nothing worse or more boring than sitting around all day listening to a bunch of preachers. And I just invite them up to the room. Have a little drink here. Waste the afternoon away, you know. And some of them said, why are you doing this? And I said, look, you know, you got to loosen up a little bit. You have to enjoy life. You can't just sit back and be like that. Couple of things I think that were really fantastic in my life. I was invited to perform a wedding about 60 miles from home, and this was in February in northern Illinois. And of course, there was a big blizzard, storm, and everything else. And we went to this church for the reception. I fell in the damn pool that was in the place there. And I haven't figured out to this day why they had a pool up in front of the church. But I fell in it for some reason. And after we had the wedding, we went to the reception. Naturally, I got drunk again, and Barbara tried to get me to go home, and I wouldn't. And then finally, they closed the bar, and I had to. And we were driving down the street, and she was, incidentally, I call her the bitch. She was on my case again about all the drinking, and she's telling me, "You're drunk, you got no business riding around like this." And I said, "I'm not letting you drive my car." And she said, "I don't want our children to be orphans. If you don't let me drive, I'd just as soon get out." So I stopped and let her out. Some people in the church went to pick her up 60 miles away. I went home and went to bed. And you know, all the way home, and she tells us in her story that she told them the truth about what was coming down in our life. And she almost had them convinced. And then they came home, and there I was. My car was parked out there, parked straight in where it belonged and everything else. I was sleeping peacefully. And that didn't work. I recall one Saturday, I was laying on the floor in the dining room, minding my own business. And she came up to me, and she kicked me, and she said, "Russell, get up. You're sick. We're going to the hospital." She had made previous arrangements for somebody to come over there, so she and this friend of hers piled me in the car, took me 28 miles over to Swedish American Hospital in Rockford, Illinois, and we walked in. Now listen, let me tell you something. You're a preacher, and you've been around taking care of people. When you go in the hospital, and you have to holler at the girl at the desk the number of the floor that you're going to, because there's no button there, you know where you're going. Psychiatric ward. And I got up there on that psych ward, and she had made arrangements with Dr. Henry, who's a wonderful person. And he took us in his office, and he said, "Well, Barbara, you know, it seems like you're really upset about things. Why don't you tell me about it?" So she did. For the next hour, she carried on, told him everything. He's ruining, this man is ruining my life. He's destroying himself. He's ruining the lives of our children. He's destroying the church and all that kind of stuff. And she cried. She's good cry. She could really cry. And then, after about an hour, Dr. Henry said, "Well, Russell, what do you think about all this?" And I just sat back and I just reached deep down. I got the best clergy voice that I could. And I told him, I said, "Well, doctor," I said, I'm really concerned about Barbara. Yeah, man. So he kept her there. God. That was for a whole month. I'm not proud of that. To me, that stands as a prime example today of alcohol is cunning and baffling and powerful. Barbara was always a wonderful wife. She was a very loving woman and everything else. But, you know, she was a threat to my drinking. So she had to go. During those 30 days, I went around the congregation. I got the most important people that I knew, the ones that had authority and power and stuff like that. And I asked each of them to give me a commitment. I said, now you know that the cheese has slipped off of Barbara's cracker, and we need to do something here. And when she comes out, I want you to make me a promise. I want you to promise me that you'll be kind to her, that you'll love her, that you'll respect her, but don't believe a word she tells you. And that's the way it was. And that's the way it continued for about five more years until I finally, you know, had to give up and things like that. Another thing in 1966, I recall that I was hospitalized for pneumonia. And I had some wonderful friends in that congregation. A jeweler and his wife, and they always got done work about 9 o'clock, and at 9 o'clock they'd come over to the hospital to see their pastor and their friend. And they would always bring me the little cartons of grasshoppers. Not real grasshoppers, you know, the drink. And the people there at the nurse, they couldn't figure out why I was so happy so late at night all the time. But I just had a great time. Oh, Russell was running the world, and he was the center of attention. And he was the center of attraction. And all the time inside, I was filled with such guilt and such shame for the things that I had done to myself and to my family and everything else. And I felt such unworthiness. When Barbara got out of the hospital at Dempsey, she got worse. She never let up. And finally, I decided, this is it. I've had enough of this woman. So I decided that I was going to go away. I left town. I left her. I left the church, I left those kids, and I took off. And I felt that drinking was far more important to me than all this insignificant other stuff that's going on in my life. I have never been back there. I got an invitation the other day from this church where I was. They're building a new church, and in August or September, they're going to dedicate their church, and they want me to come and to be their guest speaker. Okay. I am praying about that because I'll tell you what I see through that, folks, because the program has taught me this. This may be the most wonderful opportunity that I have to work Step 9 and to make my amends personally to a lot of people that I hurt. This was a big church, and I know what it's all about now. I want to say this, though, that Barbara has improved immensely the past 12 years, and I want to. And I would like to thank you Al-Anons and AAs for that, because she has listened, and she has learned like I have, and let me tell you, we have gotten better together. We've learned to respect each other's turf and to stop trying to control each other and to stop trying to boss each other around and to stop trying to fashion somebody else into your way of thinking and to your way of living. I always thought in my lifetime that I was the boss, and I had a good definition for that, you know, beautiful, overpowering, self-sufficient Superman. And I discovered something important when I sobered up, that if you spell that word backwards, that's what I was, a double S-O-B. That's a good one. We've learned together, I've learned through this wonderful program, that you cannot fly a kite without a string. You can't do that. And you can't steer a ship unless you have a rudder. And I'm grateful for the 12 steps. Finally, the last 2 weeks, I was in a blackout, and I don't know, I ended up in Hendersonville, Tennessee, and in South Carolina. And I did a wonderful thing, though, while I was there in that blackout. I resigned my position as a pastor of that church. And a couple of days later, you know, I had a moment of something or other. I looked, and there's that wonderful letter sitting on the bed there. And I read this, and it was mailed. So now I was unemployed, and I didn't know what to do. So I just drank some more. I finally decided, you know, like most people do, alcoholics sometimes are real big cowards. So when the chips got down, I was 48 years old, I went home to mommy. And I had a couple of good days there. And then on the 25th day of May in 1974, I was lying down in the hot, humid basement in a moldy bed. And it was 8 o'clock. It was time to get up and go to church because it was Sunday. And I could not get out of bed. There was nothing wrong with me physically. I could crawl out of bed. But you see, at that point, my drinking had gone. This was gone. And more important than anything else, this was gone. And I spoke three words that probably were the most difficult words that I have ever spoken in my life. I said, I need help. So they hauled me away to the Lutheran General Hospital in Park Ridge, Illinois. And of all things, they locked me up behind bars with a bunch of dope addicts. And I could not figure out why I was there. And the first couple of days, I had a chance to reflect upon what I had done with this life that God had given to me. And I said to myself, what have you done with the life that God... Look at the position that you're in. But I wasn't ready to give up because I could still handle it. And I concluded that the only reason that I was locked up behind bars with a dope addict was because God wanted me to enter into a whole new ministry. Counseling the drug addicts and the alcoholics and everything else. So I'd make appointments with them. We'd get over in the corner and say, oh, look, if you do what I tell you, you'll be all right when you get out of here. Everything will work out fine. The fourth day, one of the nurses came and she said, Russell, she said, I want you to go with me. So I did. Walked down the hall, got on the elevator up to the eighth floor, walked into a big room about half the size of this, bunch of chairs in the circle around there, full of people whimpering and whining about all the trouble alcohol's gotten them into. And I said, I don't want to hear this. I went back downstairs. A couple of days later, same nurse had come with me. Only this time, did they have a surprise for me? We got off of the elevator on the eighth floor, and there sat Barbara. And there was the psychiatrist, and there was the principal of the Christian Day School, and there was my vicar. They took us into this wonderful room again. Only this time, all the chairs were empty. And they had a little chair sitting in the middle of the room, and they said, would you mind sitting down here? And I thought to myself, what is this? I didn't know anything about intervention. I sat down in the chair, and then they all gathered around me, circled their wagons, and each one of them took their turns telling about the terrible things that were happening in my life. And Art McElfresh was the social worker there, and when they got done, he said, Russ, what are you going to do about this? And I said, I'll think about it. I went back downstairs. But before I did, I walked out the door, and Barbara was standing there. And she looked at me, and she said, Russell, you can make it. And I thought to myself, I heard the next day that this treatment center, which was a separate building, was like living in a plush country club. So I decided, what the heck? If I can get out of behind bars, I'll go over there. So I did. And I went over there and I saw the 12 steps and the 12 traditions, and I read that and I said, that's not good Lutheran theology. That's for children, you know, for women and things like that. And I was not into that thing at all. I spent 24 days in the program there. I had a wonderful time. The food was good. The people were great. They had a birthday party for me when I was there. Gave me a carton of cigarettes as a present. Everybody came to me, wanted a little advice and talk and things like that, you know. And before I left, Carl Anderson, who was was a pastor in the American Lutheran Church, and he was my, what do they call him, counselor. He told me a couple of things. He said, Russ, the staff people had a meeting, and we talked about you, and we think that you're really zany. And I thought to myself, well, now, wait a minute, zany, that means you're slightly off your rocker. And I said, that can't be right. So I immediately headed for the library, and I got this big unabridged dictionary from Webster and looked up the word zany. And sure enough, it sort of implies it a little bit off. But there's a second definition, don't know if you ever saw it. It says it's a person who brings exuberance and excitement and enthusiasm into the lives of other people. man, I thought, that's mine. That's me. I said, they know who's here. And then, one of the guys in the program told me something I thought was really significant. He said, oh, Carl said, you know, Russell, you're the classic example of a middle-aged alcoholic. Well, at that point, I hated the word alcoholic. And I didn't like the word middle age because, you know, when you're as close to God as I was, there's no age involved in this thing. But I liked the word classic. And once again, I thought to myself, they know who's here. And then one of my fellow group members said to me, Russ, you are the philosopher of X group. And I thought to myself, that's one of the best compliments I ever got in my life. And it took me a while to really figure out what he was trying to say to me. And I can best explain that to you by telling you the story of a couple of ladies that came back after 25 years from graduating from high school. They had this big reunion. One of them was dressed rather commonly. The other one comes in, man, she's all dolled up. She's got the best there is. And they struck up a little conversation. They talked about this and that. And then finally, the lady who looked like she had plenty of fluency said to her friend, Helen, do you know what my husband did for our wedding? No. Took me on a 3-month cruise in the Mediterranean. And Helen looked at her and said, boy, that's fantastic. And then she said, then you know what he gave me for a wedding present? No. Gave me this 17-room house, servants, and everything. And Helen, boy, she said, boy, that is really fantastic. And then she showed her the big rock she was wearing on her finger and said, he just gave me this for our 25th wedding anniversary, too. And she said, that is fantastic. And then finally she got off of that and she asked Helen, how's your life been all of these years? She said, oh, it's fine. It's kind of bumping along pretty good. I'm happy. Did your husband ever do anything special for you? And she said, yes. He sent me to charm school. And she said, charm school? Well, what did you learn there? And she said, I learned to say fantastic instead of bullshit. That's it. Yeah. That's what he was trying to tell me. It took me 7 months. I didn't drink during that time, but 7 months after I got out of that, you know, of course I was unemployed, but I was working in a little machine shop. The real meaning of that story in the Bible about the prodigal son came alive for me. Because the most significant words in that were the little 4 words, he came to himself. And it was at that point that God, through all of this, had brought me down low enough to where I was willing to surrender to the fact that Russell had a real problem. And things have gotten progressively better since then. They told me when I got out of the treatment program, or they said, we'd like you for research. And I thought to myself, well, that's an honor. You know, and alcoholics have these visions of grandeur. I pictured them, you know, picking my brain and writing this wonderful book, and I get all the royalties, and who have to worry about a job now? I haven't heard a thing about that. But anyhow, they said, you got to go to 3 meetings a week. And, you know, in spite of everything, I'm a complier. So I went to 3 meetings a week. I'll tell you, the greatest thing ever happened in my life, all 3 of the meetings that I picked, because in the Chicago area, there's about 500 and some a week, all 3 of the meetings that I picked were step meetings. And I want to recommend to everybody, if you don't go to a step meeting, you do it regularly. That's the foundation of the program. If you don't get the steps, you can do all kinds of talking and passing back and forth and things like that, but you got to get the steps because it keeps you mindful of where you came from and where all of the winners before us have walked. They said, this is how it works. And from that day forward, I think that things started to happen a little bit better. At any rate, about this time, you know, I began to think to myself, now you remember, I left Barbara and the kids. She sold everything I owned. And she rented a couple of U-Hauls and took the children out to New Richmond, Ohio, on the Ohio River, living in a little rat-infested shack with cockroaches. She was on welfare, aid to dependent children. But then I remembered that she had said to me, Russell, if you would only quit drinking, everything would be wonderful. And I wasn't drinking. So I decided to myself, I said, I bet you she'd be glad to see me. So I got back in the car, you know, had a suntan by then. It was nice and trim, and I drove out to Cincinnati. I finally found her. I walked up to the door of that little shack. I knocked on the door. Now, I wish you could have been there to see this, because I thought it was really exciting. She just stood there like this in the door and said, "Well, what can we do for you?" And I told her, I said, "You told me if I'd quit drinking that everything would be fine, so here I am." You know, when I first came in the program, one of the things they told me was that we must learn to forgive ourselves for what we've done. And the first night I did, I wiped the slate clean. But Barbara had trouble with that. It took her quite a while to get over that thing. But anyhow, I invited her to go to Al-Anon. She got mad at me. She kicked me out 3 times. Every time she did, I punished her. I would take the wagon and the Bank of America card and go to the West Coast, charge everything to her. Finally, she could no longer afford to kick me out. That's the way it was. It worked out pretty good that way. We got better together then. She started to go to Al-Anon. She learned the things that you gals learn about detachment and all that kind of stuff. And I was grateful because we were getting better. And then I thought to myself, I wonder if God wants me to go back into the ministry. See, I've been out about 18 months or something like that. I heard that there was a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod pastor in Cincinnati, and that he was a specialist in this field. That if you went and talked to him, he could sort of size you up, and then, he would tell you whether or not you'll ever make it. So I thought, well, it's worth the risk. So on a Saturday morning, I went downtown. I sat, and this guy talked to me for about 2.5 hours. And when we were all done, he dropped the bombshell on me. And he said, "Russell," he said, I hate to tell you this. He said, "But you'll never make it. You'll never get back in the ministry. Your church body is just a little bit too tough for that. And on top of that," he said, "I don't think you progressed very far at all." 3 weeks later, I received 2 calls back into the ministry. And I thought, well, my higher power may be a little bit smarter than this guy. So before I left town, I went back down past his house and I gave him the finger. So as a parting, that was my parting gesture. You see, I still do things I'm not proud of, even though I'm not drinking. But nevertheless, I felt good at getting that thing out of my system. I took a call down to Enterprise, Alabama. And I had been down there, and a lot of good things had begun to happen, in my life. I discovered that you cannot, go down to the bottom and just bounce around at your leisure. You know, when you hit the bottom, there's no bounce left, I guess. And all the time, I believe that God was saying to me, "Well, Mr. Big Shot, are you finally ready to listen? Mr. Know-it-all? Are you finally ready to let somebody else do the talking? Are you ready to take a look at what a sad and disgusting person you turned into? There is a better way of life, because I've got an organization out there called AA, and it's just for you. So you go, and you listen, and you do." In AA, I cut my teeth on a new way of life. I never found that in the church. And I'm not knocking churches, because I love my church and I love my people. But it was in AA that I cut my teeth. And I found this new way of life, because I saw it in action in people like you. You don't always see that in churches. But here I see it day in and day out with thousands of people that I've met since that day. And I'm thankful to God today that I did not get what I deserved. I have received such grand deliverance from a life of slavery to my ego and to myself. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you can take your material things in life, and you can take all the glory, and you can take all the honor that people like to heap, whatever respect there might be, and you just give me a thing called sobriety with contentment, and that's enough for me. And I'm grateful for that. Today, I am God's sober drunk, and everybody in my church knows that. We use our church 4 nights a week to promote the program. and it works out pretty good. I was recently asked, through I did not look for the job or anything like that, but I'm also now the part-time chaplain at the Bradford Treatment Center in Prattville, Alabama. My people support me 100% in that. They also support giving me these nice weekends off, which I appreciate too, because it's wonderful. You know, a lot of good things that came out of that. I needed help so desperately. I cried out for help, and God used folks like you to give it to me. And I love you for helping me. And I love you for helping me. I really do. In the meantime, Barbara and I renewed our vows. And she said she felt she was living in sin after all that behavior on my part. So we renewed our vows, and we feel good. I think what I have learned through all of life is this. You know, I alone can live my program of sobriety. But I'm sure grateful for all the guidance and the help that I get. And I'm glad for that. We have the tools in our program to provide some great things. I just want to share a couple of those things that I've learned that are very important to me. You know, every bird has to whistle through his own beak. And that's exactly what I'm able to do today. I don't expect to be like anybody else in the program. I need to be me, and I need to recognize my limitations. I need to be grateful. I also need to recognize and to have a sense of compassion that other people also have a right to hurt. That's the thing that is called humility. And that's the thing that Russell desperately needed. And that is the thing that, by the grace of God, part of that has started in my life. My sponsor in Cincinnati told me one time, he said, Russ, we've got a H of a program in AA. And I agree with him. There's a thing that's called honesty. I never knew what honesty was until I got into program. I was an accomplished liar. I could manipulate and use and abuse, and that was nothing, just snap of the fingers, just like that. But I got honest and faced myself and said, you're not a nice person at all. I look at myself today and say, you're a nice person, but remember where your help came from. There's a thing in the program that is called help. I read a little story about a guy who was out fishing one day, and he caught a little 6-inch fish, and he took it off the hook and put it in his creel, and took another one 9 inches, put it in his creel, caught a big 20-inch lunker, took it off the hook, threw it back in the lake. And the little boy was watching him, and he said, hey, mister, he said, how come you kept the little ones and threw the big ones back? He said, I only got a 10-inch skillet. And I think the point is, that we have a skillet that will fit anybody's bottom. There's help for anyone who wants the help. And it doesn't make any difference where you're at. Okay? There's a thing that is called humor. I love it. We can laugh about things that before were so tragic. I was sitting in my office one day, I'll never forget this. I was sitting in the office one day, and one of the elders of the church came in and he said, hey, pastor, incidentally, before I forget, let me thank you for giving me my name back. Because I would never allow anybody to call me Russ. I'd say I'm the pastor. That's what you call me. And now hardly anybody does. And I kind of like that. Thank you very much. But now he said, Pastor, did you hear about this kook in town? So he's, 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, he's roaring around the towns in his robes on his bicycle. I said, no, I hadn't heard about that. And he said, well, he did. He said, the cops found out about that now, and they're looking for him. So I quit. You talk about doing some crazy. That's what I love to do. I get drunk as a loon. And I'm not talking about bathrobes. I get those beautiful church robes, and I put them on, and put the stole on, and get on the bike and roar along the streets of that town. And I quit when I heard that. And there's a lot of humor, and I appreciate that. There's a thing that is called humanity. God, through this program, gives us back our humanity. We become worthwhile people again. We become good citizens of a wonderful land in which we live. And we become people who have learned something, that we have a care, we have a concern for other people. God gives that back to us through our program. There's a thing in AA that's called hope. And the second step to me is one of the most beautiful of all. I came to believe that beautiful process by which we hear the stories of so many other people, and they tell us this is how it's worked, and then we come to believe that that's the way it can work for me too. And I like that. And then we make a decision and give it to God. Say, I'm going to trust Him. And that was a great step in my life. I was a religious person, but it was very difficult for me to truly, honestly work step two and three, because I thought I had all the answers. I thought God was in my pocket. And then I had to come to believe, and I thought I did. And I believe to this day. Remember that story about Pandora? You know, she buried Epimetheus, the Greek fable, and everything else. Anyhow, she went to this new kingdom and opened up her box and lit up all these terrible things. So they call it Pandora's box. And opened the lid, and all the evil is left out on the world. And we alcoholics are like that. It says in the big book, you know, we're like tornadoes roaring through the lives of other people without even caring. And but let me ask you something, if you know that story. Everything was left out of that box except one thing that was still lying in the bottom. Do you know what it was? Hope. So in spite of all of the things that we have unleashed, and you hear the invitation to get better, there's hope. We offer that hope, and that's the hope that I continue to live in. I still live in that hope today that every day will be just a little bit better. So you hang on, you hang in, you stay with the winners, and you'll get a lot of love. And you've taught me how to love again. I never knew how to love. I never really did. But I know how to love people today. And when I tell somebody today, I really love you, boy, you can count on it. There's the sincerity there. That means that I'm willing to put whatever I am and have on the line for them at any time. And that's a big change for me. I think I spent a lot of stuff in that film. The other thing I've learned is AA teaches us, you get off your pity pot, live your life. How many of you like people on their pity pot? Nobody likes us. I'll tell you something, that's a fact of life. All you ever get sitting on your pity pot is a ring around your hiney. And the longer you sit on that, the bigger and the harder the ring gets. So we have to learn to do that. There was a time, I have to admit, that I wasn't really sure that I could make it. But I did. So that reminds me of a little story of three clergy couples. They went to a big conference, you know, the husbands and wife teams. And on the way home, they were all traveling together. All of them got killed in an accident. And being clergy, they thought that they should be able to get into heaven with no problems at all. First one waltzes up there with his wife and says, here I am. And St. Peter says, whoa, hold it there, man. We know a lot more about you up here than they do down there. Because we know that all of these years you've been dipping your hands in the offering basket. And on top of that, he said, look, you married this woman named Penny. And the second couple went up there and they said, I'm ready. They said, hold it. We know more about you up here than they do about you down there. He said, we know that you're just nothing but an old drunk. You've been drinking all the time and pretending and so forth. And it's on top of that, you married that woman named Brandy. And the third couple went up there, and the guy, he just turned his wife and he said, come on, Fanny, we'll never make it. Let's get out of here. I never really thought that I was going to make it, but you see, God oftentimes has some interesting things in store for people that somewhere, somehow down the line, it begins to click. And God always has a person in your life, if you're paying attention, when they're needed. And that person will be there to help you. I watch out today for the little disturbances in my life. We can basically handle the big ones. In 1979, I went up north to get my parents. They were both in their 80s. I brought them down in Montgomery to live with us. And in January of 1980, my father was in the hospital. I told Barbara, I'm going to sit with Dad this afternoon. I went over there and found him dead in bed. And I got on the phone and called my brothers and my sister, and I called all of my children. And we have a very loving family now, incidentally. I mean, a very close family. They all came. I had a son who lived in Rockford at the time and a daughter who lived in St. Louis. Now, she had a little 3-year-old girl and a little 4-month-old baby boy named Miles Benjamin. And they drove down that next day. That night, the little baby died of crib death in the house. And now I went through all the grieving and all that kind of stuff that goes with it. But I never once thought about drinking or anything like that. See, never thought about that. I think they were worried about me doing that, but I never thought about that. And then a couple of years later, my mother died. And I called everybody. They all came to the funeral again. My little baby sister from Tacoma was there. She was 39. And the night of the funeral, she dropped dead of a massive heart attack. And we went through the grieving process and all that again, you know. But I never drank and never even thought about it. I think they were concerned about whether I would. But I never did that. And I learned something important about that. That we seem to have the ability through the gift of this program to handle those major crises in our life. But it's those blasted little things that get at you. Like something that somebody says or somebody's not doing what you want them to do. And I heard about a fellow in the program where everything was just going to pot for his life, you know, happening. His wife died. His son was in an automobile accident and he was crippled for life. His daughter was studying chemistry in a lab. They had an explosion that blinded her for life. And one of his friends said, "Well, Henry, what the heck is it going to take to get you to drink again?" And he said, "Well, maybe I'll run out of toilet paper." And that's about it. Yeah. That's about it. The other thing that you have taught me, with which I'm grateful, is you can't keep what you do not give away. When you receive, you give it away, and you'll get more in return. That's just one of the laws of AA. I found that out a long time ago. And I came across a little thing which I think is important, is seeking to care and daring to give. Before I die, I will finally live. And that summarizes exactly how I feel about the gift that God has given to me through people like you. Another thing that I have learned that has been beneficial to me as I've learned how to talk to myself. So I don't know if any of you talk to yourself, but I think it's important that you do that if you haven't started to do that. I get up in the morning, I look in the mirror and I say, "Good morning, you old drunk." And if I don't answer, I'm in trouble. I'm in trouble. I want to end up this whole thing tonight. You know, you've done so much for me, and I thank you again. But let me tell you the story about the two grasshoppers. And this has some real deep meaning. Now, you listen closely. There were these two grasshoppers that fell in this bowl of thick, rich cream. And the first grasshopper looked around and he said, "Holy smoke, am I ever in trouble? I better do something fast or I'm going to be in real trouble." And he just kept feeling sorry for himself. And no, he couldn't get over what's going on in his life. And he felt so sorry for himself and he did nothing. And guess what? He drowned. And the second grasshopper fell into his bowl of thick, rich cream and he said to himself, "Holy smoke, I better do something faster. I'll never get out of this thing alive." So he just started kicking up his heels and singing his little grasshopper song. And the first thing you know, he turned that cream into solid butter. And he walked away to safety. When we come into the program and we recognize our problem, we can be like number one if you want to. Sit on your pity pot, feel sorry for yourself, don't do anything, and guess what? You go right back to the old ways, you die again. Or you can be like grasshopper number two. And that is that you can say, "I better do something about my life fast." So you just keep singing your song and kicking up your heels and walking those 12 steps, and the first thing you know, you take that old shaky foundation we had when we first came in, and you turn it into a beautiful, solid foundation for the rest of your life. And you can walk away into the sunset, sober, serene, content, with everything that you never thought that you would ever have. And on those mornings, when I get up and I don't feel like talking to myself, I just raise two fingers. Grasshopper number two. And then I never forget. I love you very much. Thank you.